Welcome to the Ask Sensei Tony podcast, where Sensei will address your questions about life from a cosmic perspective. Please subscribe and ask a question at AskSenseiTony.com to find out more about studying with Sensei privately, becoming a part of our spiritual community, and training to become a mindful minister of oneness in our seminary. We hope you enjoy this episode and find it helpful.
Hi, this is Sensei Tony. And today's question is from Chris, and he asks, how do you cultivate oneness when you're not getting along with someone or you're feeling disconnected? So, as I always say, the first thing that we have to do is we have to define the terms that we're using. And even though I would say that most of my subscribers here are pretty familiar with the concept of oneness, let me just give a brief definition of that again. Oneness to me is the experience of realizing how everything is interconnected. And that realization is one that overcomes the feeling of separation that I think we all suffer from at some level, existentially. And so anything that helps me to overcome that sense of separation is a way or a path to oneness. So we talk about oneness with ourselves or within ourselves, oneness with others, oneness with the world, and the mystery of oneness. So Chris's question is, how do we experience oneness with someone that we're having difficulties with? And it's a good question. And I think that, you know, specific examples might help, but I'll try to give you a more general response, and then maybe we can, I'll give you a couple examples of what I mean. So let's do the first one. Let's say that it's oneness with someone else and with others, with a person that we're not getting along with. You know, and there's all kinds of reasons why people don't get along with others. Some of those reasons are really conscious and we're aware of. Other times, you know, it's less clear. I don't know about you, but I've certainly had the experience of, you know, kind of going into a room or you know, meeting someone for the first time, and for whatever reason, I don't have a connection to them. I don't feel like I like them. And it's something that is like an unconscious reaction. Now, what's behind all of that? Why would I have that kind of reaction to someone? Well, there's a multiplicity of variables that could be involved. I mean, it could be something as simple as like I'm picking up a smell of someone. I know it sounds strange, but that's like one of our oldest sensory inputs. And you know, if someone, for whatever reason, let's not say necessarily that they have body odor, but they have some kind of smell that I don't like, I may not even be aware of that at first, that that's kind of impacting my reaction. And as we know, in our understanding of how things flow, in the sense of interdependent origination or causation, there must be a thought connected to that experience. And so it could be the way the person looks reminds me of something or someone that maybe I'm conscious of or not. But there's some kind of thought there. There's some kind of process going on. And it's probably so unconscious that I'm just in the feeling mode. And the feeling mode is kind of kicking up all my other systems, you know, my nervous system, you know, my autonomic nervous system. So, you know, the first step is when I find myself in a situation like that where I meet someone and for whatever reason there's kind of a sort of a repelling sort of feeling going on, a repellent sort of experience. I may not have the time then at that moment to analyze what's happening. But at the very least, what I can do is I can, you know, kind of move past that feeling and you know, be cordial and respectful. And that's where good manners come in, you know, and it's really important to know how to interact with others socially. And a lot of people really don't. And to show good manners, even when you might have other kinds of feelings going on. Because one of the things we all know is that no matter what we're feeling, we can act however we want. We don't have to act out of that feeling. So I would say mindfully, the first thing to do would be to act in such a way that I'd feel that was respectful and kind. And, you know, listen to the person. And then if that feeling doesn't go away, then what I would do is later, when I had the opportunity to, sit and contemplate and figure this out, if it's really unconscious, then I might have to employ, you know, sitting with it for a while in meditation and allowing that situation to work kind of like a, what they say in Zen is like a koan, you know, it's like a question or a situation that if you work with it, resolve it, you experience oneness. And so I might sit with it for a while and kind of pay attention to the unconscious stuff that comes up. The other thing I can do, of course, is the four questions. And the four questions will probably get me to the answer fairly quickly. And that's something that if, you know, you practice the four direction system of mindfulness, you'll know that the four questions is kind of the heart of the practice. I'm not going to go into that here, but essentially it's to take the situation, look at the physical and emotional reactions going on. And especially in such something like this, you want to look at the physical, because the physical may be speaking in a way that the emotional is not. And then you want to find out what the strongest feeling was, physically or emotionally. And remember, in our practice, we look at the body as an emotion. And then I want to find out what the thoughts were that were creating that feeling. And that's where meditation can really be a powerful servant to mindfulness, in the sense that the more you are comfortable with being spacious in the midst of different thoughts and reactions going on, the more likely unconscious stuff becomes more conscious. And I often think of meditation as a way of making the unconscious conscious. And there's other ways to do that too. Certainly working with dreams or free association can be a path to that. But I find that, you know, meditation is a very effective tool for that. So then once I know what the thoughts are, then I take the strongest thought and then I do the four questions. You know, I basically want to find out what's not clear about that thought. I want to find out where the conditioning came from. I want to connect myself with others that may have been going through that. And in this case, maybe the person might be feeling the same way towards me, and contemplate that. And then the fourth question is to sort of put all the earlier answers together and then kind of come up with a more enlightened statement. And then what action can I take to manifest or realize what insight I had? Because insight plus experience equals realization. So, you know, it would be very hard for me to say in any particular situation why I might have that kind of reaction without taking the time to contemplate it and take it through a process like the four direction system, particularly the four questions. But I can guarantee you that if I do that, I'm going to come up with an answer. And my action then will be the way for me to, you know, create oneness with that person. And, you know, without having a specific example, you know, it's kind of hard to go further than that in the explanation. But what I could do is give you an example of someone that I had that experience with in the past. And this was a person I met for the very first time when I was in graduate school. And, you know, I just right off the bat just had that kind of reaction to that person. And, you know, part of it was when I actually contemplated and looked at it, there were a lot of things that came up. Thoughts that came up driving that strongest feeling. And the strongest feeling was just, you know, kind of repellent again, And I remember that a lot of thoughts came up. And one of the thoughts that came up around this person was that I was jealous of this person because this person was, financially, this person had their whole thing paid for, unlike myself, that I had to work and also borrow heavily to attend graduate school in Cambridge, and this person didn't. They were called trust fund babies, and I had known that about this person before I met them. Someone had told me that. So that influenced the way I was feeling. They kind of had, this, typically classically handsome person, beautiful wife, just kind of this thing where, I have a beautiful wife, and so there wasn't quite the jealousy around that, but it was just a sense that, this person was just like your classic sort of situation. So that came up. I got from that person that they weren't overly the kind of person who was overly friendly. In other words, they were kind of reserved or stood off a little bit. And the thought I had was that they were kind of snobbish and that this person, kind of thought maybe they were better than other people. And that was, again, the thought I had. So I had all these kind of thoughts going on. So, when you looked at it from that point of view, you realized that I knew nothing about this person really intimately on a one-on-one basis. But these were all things that my thoughts had kind of come up with, or I had heard from other people, or, I had inferred. And so it's no surprise that I felt that way. And, the insight that I gained from it was that I was going to try to, get to know the person. So in this case, I did that, and I made these efforts towards knowing this person, and this person, pretty much thwarted me at every step. And it didn't seem to matter how magnanimous I was or how friendly I was, this person just wasn't interested. And, then as other people got to know this gentlemen, they had similar thoughts and feelings like I did, And so, at the end of the day, this guy was kind of like that. He had a little bit of arrogance, a little bit of snobbery going on. So it wasn't just my reading, although I think it's always good to check that out. And I want to go any too far into the actual personal stuff around it, because I don't want, I want to keep anonymity here. But I will say this, that this person had a fall from grace. And when they had this fall from grace, the same folks that kind of clamored around this person and kind of, lifted them up and sort of idolized them, as people are wont to do, they'll be throwing palm leaves at your feet one day and nailing you to a tree the next day. Excuse me, that's just the way people are. And so I remember when this person had a fall from grace, and a lot of people had kind of rejected him. I saw that as a place where I could connect with him out of compassion. And I never, I never dreamed or imagined we'd be best buddies or anything like that, or, going out for smoke, but I can relate to his suffering. And so, I think that's the answer at the end of the day, is that, and I think that's the reason the Buddha emphasized the teaching of suffering, dukkha, not because he was moribund or, a negative person or, anything like that, but more from the point of view of, this was the easiest way for us to connect with others, the easiest way for me to experience oneness with another person is that through suffering and recognizing their suffering and then wanting to connect on that to help relieve it. And so I did. you know? And, you know, it wasn't like I say, we became best buddies or anything like that. But we did overcome that initial wall that was there. And while I never really knew this person beyond that period of time, I remember, you know, at the end of our, you know, sojourn there, that we had come to much friendlier terms, and I think a sense of mutual respect for each other. Because this guy was very smart, and he was intelligent, and he had a lot to offer. And, you know, we were able to overcome that. So that's kind of my recommendation with someone, is just try to connect where they're suffering. You know, there's the ego part of you when someone is like that, you know, like I say, it's knocked off their perch. The ego self is kind of like, So there's a little bit of the ego self that kind of draws the attention first. But when you are sincerely practicing from the true self and your, you know, daily devotionals of taking refuge and so forth, the ego self is not the impediment, but rather the ego self, interestingly, is the way in. And so, yeah, when I saw this guy knocked off, my ego self was like, there you go, buddy. You know, but it was also at the same time, simultaneously, like, oh, man, you know, maybe this is an opportunity for us to connect where I wasn't able to before, you know, and maybe it wasn't his problem, it was my problem. And so the ego self is not the enemy here. And in fact, its weaknesses are our strength, because we can use those openings, those chinks in the armor, as a way for light to come in. And we can work with those rather than trying to eliminate them or pretend like they're not there. So yeah, that's how you would do it with others. When you try to expand that, you know, with the world, I think, you know, especially, you know, when it comes to certain things that we really are passionate about. So what are people passionate about? Well, I don't know. I kind of start with myself. So I'm passionate about music. I'm passionate about films. I'm passionate about martial art. I'm passionate about, you know, political world, things like that. And I think all those areas are things where I could, you know, find myself at great odds with someone else. And so if I encounter someone who has a very different view from me on a particular subject, if my intention is that I want to experience oneness with everyone, the first thing I have to do is recognize that it may not always be possible, in the sense that, you know, we're going to have this great connection and it'll turn into this great friendship, or that, you know, we'll be able to kind of, you know, walk arm in arm down the road. And I don't think that's required. I think what's really the kind of bottom line necessity here for realizing the intention of oneness is just to connect with the person in such a way as that you remove fear from them, and you remove fear from yourself. And you find that you can engage in some kind of meaningful dialogue. And so, you know, if I encounter someone who's very passionately holding a different view than me, let's say politically, the thing that I want to do is I want to really hear them and listen to them. Because if I do, then I'm going to come at it from a different place. And when I say listen, I think of that as an act of compassion. So I want to find something, is that those of you that study the four direction system, you know, one of our practices is the psychological disarm, psychic jujitsu, so to speak. And one of the things I'll do is I'll find something I can agree with in what the person's saying, even if, you know, I might not agree completely, or maybe I only agree with 1% out of 100, or maybe I only agree temporarily, you know, sort of to try to create a dialogue. not being inauthentic, but just finding a place where I can agree, you know. And that happens a lot when you, especially when you get into discussions on politics, is that, you know, people get very passionate, and there's a tendency to think that their opinion is the only opinion that's correct. And when you come at it from a place of humility, where you know that your opinion, even if it's passionately held, may not be seeing everything, or could change at some time, some point, I think that you create a different sort of interaction and opening with that person. And then, you know, you want to draw them in by finding something you agree with. So if somebody says something to me that I completely find that their main view, I think, is in error, and I think that carrying out their view would lead to more suffering, there's always something I can find in that I can agree with. And if I can kind of just use that as a starting point, then we can kind of work our way backwards in order to do that. And I think that that approach allows the other person's defense mechanisms to go down, and then they're going to be open. Because if you study the four-direction system, you'll know that one of the things we learn, one of the models we work with, uses the transactional language of psychology to transliterate some of the teachings of the Dharma. We use the idea of the ego self having different voices and different ways of communicating. And that when that hurt part of us is kind of actively defending itself, you know, the ego self's defense mechanisms are actively kind of working to protect us from, you know, something we're afraid of, or we've been hurt, and so it kind of is there to, anger is often what comes up, because anger is there to protect us from hurt. But what can happen is that if we keep feeding that the same way, and we're not open to a more heuristic sort of process whereby we can be passionate about a view without necessarily believing we're absolutely correct, or without believing that, you know, something else might come along where we might change our minds, or we might amend or ameliorate our opinion, then that turns into hatred. And then that's where, you know, people feel really separate from each other. And when the further apart you feel from someone, the less human they are. And so the more likely you are to, you know, act towards them in a destructive way. But I think people of goodwill and good intention can work with this process in the manner that I'm sharing and overcome that, you know. So like I said, if I find someone who offers an opinion on something that I really don't agree with, and I start by finding something in what they're saying, you know. So if they throw out five items, you know, I might find that there's one item or two that I can kind of associate with. Then I might, you know, use that as our common landing ground, and we kind of focus on that and talk about how we might go about dealing with that problem, you know, what the origins of that problem were, and then, you know, how we might come to a solution. And I really believe that when people have the right intention, you know, they're basically trying to relieve suffering, and they're trying to basically lift us up, and live, you know, wanting you to and me to have, you know, the freedom to express ourselves and the fullness of that expression, then, you know, I think even if we have different ways of getting there, we probably want the same thing. We just might have a different way of getting to that situation. But I think that once we've arrived at that kind of clarity with each other, just like the disarm always affects, it seems, if I don't fill up the space, then it's likely the person might find something in what I, you know, in what they think my view is, that they'll try to kind of make and bridge that gap. So that's the magic of the disarm. You know, once someone says something to me, makes a statement, I first acknowledge how I'm feeling, my reaction. And I don't have to share that. And I can kind of do the, I call the wave or the blue wave breath, where I kind of imagine a nice warm blue wave coming over my head and body and out my feet. When I let those, you know, feelings kind of be released. And I acknowledge, and I think the person, you know, what they're saying is stupid, and I think their opinion is, you know, incorrect or whatever. Whatever, you know. Then once I acknowledge that, then I can reset and reaffirm that my intention is to be one. And so then the next step for me to do is find something that I can agree with what they're saying. And when I've disarmed them, I'll know I've disarmed them because they won't know what to say. In other words, I'm taking myself out of the equation. I'm not making myself a target anymore. So they've got to kind of, they've got their nervous system, everything about them is looking for a target, you know, bang, bang, bang. But if I don't offer that to them, then they go off balance. And the way you know you've disarmed someone is because they don't know what to say next. Or they're a bit perplexed. And if you can try not to fill up the space too quickly with words, but let that experience of disarm sort of marinate the experience. I have found, crazy as it may sound, that the person will start to come up with things that will connect us. You know, and people ask me, why is that? Why is it if I disarm someone and I'm no longer a target for them, suddenly they start to seem to kind of come up with, you know, alternative things that might connect us or say something now that connects us? Why do they do that? You know, why wouldn't they just keep at it? I my own opinion is this. I don't agree with the idea that human beings have evolved from primarily a place of separation. I think that separation and that experience is a normal part of our development, but I don't think it's the primary one. And I think that, you know, if we look to science just to help us understand how things work, and we bring that in harmony with why things matter, which I think of as spirituality, newer studies are showing that we seem to be wired for connection. And even game theory seems to show us that on some level altruism is more successful. So I think we're actually wired more for that. And I think that's why we get so weird and we do such terrible things when we feel separate. You know, that kind of actually confirms that hypothesis or theory. I think it's more of a theory because I think the evidence we have now is fitting that. But I think that's why we react that way. You know, we feel alienated, which is interesting because the first, you know, Western psychotherapists were called alienists. Anyway, it's all about helping people feel, experience not being alien anymore. I think that's why. I think that's why we react so strongly with it, because it's so much not what we are. I think that science shows us that we're actually wired for connection. And that when we have connection, you know, we're capable of being angels. And whenever we're not experiencing that connection, you know, we can be demonic in our actions. However, I would still not identify my being with any particular reaction. And that's part of our practice too, is learning to have this sense of refuge in what we call the true self, or our Buddha nature, our true nature, that is not based upon my actions, and it's not determined by them or predicated by the opinions of others. And certainly, and I think this is very important, one action that I take that maybe is wrong or stupid, or, you know, you deem wrong or somebody deems wrong, or it seems to be a mistake, that doesn't wipe out everything. Not my book. You know, and today there's a sense that no matter what kind of life you've led and all the good stuff you've done, you make one mistake, everything else is gone. Not on my watch. You know, heaven help us if that's the way we're going to judge other people, because wow, good luck with that one. I mean, all you do when you kind of set up a system or society like that is that you just you know, it becomes impossible. First of all, it's based on perfection, which doesn't exist, in my opinion, doesn't exist, and, you know, is the most pernicious problem that humans really face and creates most of our suffering. It's based on that. And when you get rid of perfection and you replace that with the idea of wholeness, with the goal of wholeness, then you can integrate everything. You can integrate the good, the bad, and the ugly, you know? And so when you're working with somebody that you don't connect with right away, and you're trying to create a sense of oneness with them, the easiest way to go is to kind of connect with your own sense of where you haven't felt connected. And it's a very powerful way. I've found that people who have fallen short, so to speak, at times, are much less judgmental people. And there's got to be a reason for that, right? There's got to be some wisdom in that. I mean, if you have the great sages, Buddha, Christ, you know, people telling us that we shouldn't judge, and really saying we shouldn't judge, and it must be important, and it must be something organic, that when we judge others, we're really disconnected from our own suffering and from our own weaknesses. And that when we use that insight that suffering is the easiest way to connect to others, then it's not so hard. So, all that to be said, to sum it up, Chris, find your own suffering and find their suffering and find out where you connect. And I guarantee you, while it might not make you best friends, you never know. Thank you.
You've been listening to Ask Sensei Tony. Please visit our website at AskSenseiTony.com, check out Sensei's books and videos, and become a part of the Dragonfly spiritual lifestyle.